another edition of Raising San Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, with Amina and Galuli to introduce today's show. Author Alice Rothschild will talk with us about her book, Broken Promises, Broken Dreams. We'll also hear a remarkable presentation by Dr. Jill Balty-Taylor, a neuroanatomist whose specialty is the postmortem investigation of the human brain as it relates to schizophrenia and severe mental illness. In 1996, Dr. Taylor suffered a stroke, and 8 years later, she shares what she learned from that experience and why peace is possible. Alice Rothschild, author of Broken Promises, Broken Dreams, is a medical doctor whose contribution to the very first edition of Our Bodies, Ourselves, a classic for women of the 60s generation, brought her to study the healthcare system and its relationship to political and social environments. Alice Rothschild then turned much of her non-medical focus to understanding the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and its relationship to U.S. foreign policy and American Jewry. She co-chairs American Jews for a Just Peace, Health, and Human Rights Project. Welcome, Alice Rothschild.
Thank you very much.
I have thoroughly enjoyed this book, and I'm going to ask you to begin by giving our listeners a brief summary of your personal and intellectual evolution towards writing the book.
Well, I think that like many people born in the late 40s, I grew up with the idea of Israel as this perfect, magical place. You know, I went to Hebrew school 3 days a week. I was in a conservative family. We went for a pilgrimage when I was 14. And it was just, you know, I remember the soldiers that were so handsome and so perfect and sort of the platonic ideal of a soldier and the beautiful hills and the archaeologic digs. And it was a place that we just loved and we supported uncritically. And our love of Israel came out of the horrors of the Holocaust and our being Jewish people in America. And that's sort of the platform that I started with. As I became more educated, learned about the women's movement, healthcare reform, the Vietnam War, all the sort of critical turning points that happened to me, I began to look at the world very differently. And I began to understand things like colonialism and imperialism and nationalism and all the sort of conflicts that really shape the world's crises. And what I became aware of is that, and this was a very long and painful journey, I became aware that there was a story about the founding of Israel and the state of Israel itself that I hadn't heard. And that much like as children we learned that Columbus discovered America and, you know, America was a great country, and only later did we learn that there were Native Americans or that there was a civil rights struggle or all the things that make a country have a real history, that there was a real history to Israel that I was not aware of. And this was one of those hot topics that, you know, you couldn't bring up at the dinner table because everybody would start screaming at each other. So for many years, I just felt uncomfortable, but I didn't know what to do with that discomfort. And in 1997, a group of both secular and humanist Jews were sitting around on Yom Kippur next to a pond, and we were trying to figure out what we were going to do as a political activity for the coming year. And we realized we were coming up to the Israel 50th anniversary. And in Boston, there was going to be a huge celebration, sort of like the 4th of July, with Israeli bands and face painting and bagel making and all that kind of celebratory stuff. And that probably there was going to be no mention of Palestinians and of the issues of peace and justice and the kind of things that we were worrying about. So we had this slightly crazy idea that we were going to submit a proposal to the mainstream organization that was developing this celebration to have a peace forum with a Palestinian, with a Middle East activist, with an academic, with a rabbi. We had this whole idea, and that they would say no, and then we would have a protest march, and that was our idea of our political activity. And much to their credit, they said yes. So then we were sort of sitting around stunned that now we had to actually do this, and we really didn't know enough to do it. So we started a meeting and basically a dialogue group where we met with Palestinians, with other Arab-speaking people, with Mideast scholars, with all sorts of people that, you know, a nice Jewish girl would not run into in her daily life. And I began to hear a whole history and a whole side of the conflict that had previously not been really defined for me. And this was really liberating for me because suddenly the pieces seemed more understandable. And we were able to pull off this peace forum. We had 200 people in the middle of this huge celebration. We had kids, you know, painting Jewish and Arab faces and flags, and it was just sort of a stunning minor little victory for us. And it was such a powerful experience that a number of us decided that we had to keep doing this. So we organized a group that kept going, and we became more politically active. We started having lectures and inviting speakers and doing political actions. And the more we became visible, even though we were still very little, the more backlash we got. And very quickly, we were totally blacklisted from the Jewish community in Boston. And in fact, we had events in temples that were canceled. You know, and we knew that someone from the temple talked to someone from, whether it's the Israeli consul or the David Project or whoever, and they said, don't have those guys there. So that was kind of an interesting experience to find out that even just talking about this stuff stimulated, you know, hate mail and weird phone calls and an inability to get out in the public. Mm-hmm. So as we kept meeting, a number of us who are in the medical world decided, well, maybe we could look at this through the lens of healthcare and human rights. And one of the pediatricians in the group had done this kind of work in Central America. So we basically developed a health and human rights project that works with Physicians for Human Rights, which is an Israeli human rights organization, and with Palestinian Medical Relief Society, and we've also branched out to a lot of other organizations. And we started doing yearly delegations to Israel, the West Bank, once to Gaza, working with NGOs and people who are willing to cross lines and, you know, engage in dialogue and action. And it's been a stunning experience, and it's really changed my whole outlook on life. And because it's been so powerful and so moving, and because this is such a difficult topic, I really felt compelled to write a book about it. And the book uses the personal histories of people and the personal stories to be able to reach people across divides that they usually can't make. So that's sort of my, you know, very quick personal story.
You have a whole chapter about Gila Sversky, too.
Right.
Can you talk about her? In some ways, her story parallels yours, doesn't it?
In some ways, yes. She was a nice Jewish girl from New Jersey, but she came from a much more religious family. I didn't come from a religious family. We went to Hebrew school and celebrated Shabbos, but we didn't keep kosher or anything like that. And she was one of the people who made Aliyah, which means making a sort of spiritual pilgrimage to Israel, and really was on track to become a settler. And because she was also very interested in human rights issues and saw her Jewish tradition as being part of a progressive human rights tradition, she fell into understanding that there was a Palestinian narrative. And she has this wonderful story that I have in my book where she meets this Palestinian who's very articulate and savvy, and she can't believe this woman's a Palestinian. She says, well, where were you from before Ramallah? And the woman says, I am from Ramallah. And so she brought with her all the prejudices that we were all brought up with. And gradually she realized she had to be working for, crossing lines. She got involved with B'Tselem and with a variety of women's political movements. And so she's been a political activist and actually sort of left her Orthodox tradition, did not become a settler, and took a whole different track. So she's a different version of this journey, I think, but similar.
Well, actually, it reminds me, I myself went to Israel when I was 19. I had been exposed to the Habonim group. My family is not Jewish, but we had a little hotel, and the Habonim group would come up and learn about Zionism there. And I saw all of the script and heard all of this language and heard all of this romance, and I thought, oh, I have to go there.
Absolutely.
And so it was the same. I think you and I are probably around about the same age, and was the same narrative that was going on around the world, I think, about.
It's a very beautiful, compelling narrative.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that it's very flawed.
Yeah, and we're only just beginning to explore that, and it's
right.
Very hard to explore that.
Absolutely.
So you beautifully encapsulate the complexities and the contradictions of defining oneself as a Zionist when you discuss your meeting with Rabbi Levi Wayman Kelman and his wife Paula.
Right.
Talk about that, and particularly Levi's son lives with settlers in Gush Katif in Gaza, and he's apparently very pessimistic about what it will take to solve these issues.
Well, first of all, the rabbi and his wife are two very wonderful, progressive people who are very interested in issues of social justice. They are also very committed to a Zionist state. And, they brought their children up in what they call the bubble, which is a very sort of progressive, pro-dialogue with Arabs kind of group. And their temple is, I believe it's a Reconstructionist temple, which is kind of unusual in Israel. And he's a very powerful sort of force in that sector of society. His son was very committed to serving in the army as a medic, and he didn't live with the settler sons. He was in the army with them. So his exposure to more right-wing Jews occurred in the army. And I think for him was a big reality test. Now, this interview happened before the settlers were removed from Gaza, and so he was very pessimistic about what the removal of the Jewish settlers, the 8,000 or so Jewish settlers from Gaza, would mean, because he saw the settler sons in the army being totally committed to staying there. And so he had this encounter with the right wing, which was very different than the family he grew up in. I haven't spoken with him since that particular interview, so I don't know what happened to the son. Mm-hmm. Or, the settlers were removed, and, we know the history of what happened afterwards. Mm-hmm. But, his son had, Israel's a very complicated society, and there are different bubbles of experience and different political outlooks, and the army is a place where you get to see and meet with people who are very different than you, who grew up in a very different place than you did. And I don't think it could be any far different from being the rabbi's son versus being a right-wing settler living in Gaza. It's sort of both of the extremes, I think.
Yeah, the bubbles, that's a good apt description, I think. Can you surface some of the other bubbles that exist? Because I think that there's a sense that Israel is a more homogeneous place than it actually is.
Right. Israel is not at all homogeneous. I mean, if you look at a country that's largely immigrants, first of all, you have, a million people who came from Russia, some of whom are Jewish, some of whom aren't. You have people who came before the founding of the state. You have people who lived there before the founding of the state. You have people who came after the Holocaust and their families. You have people that are not from Eastern Europe, that are from North Africa. There are Jews from a number of Arab countries, such as Yemen and Kuwait and Iraq. I mean, there's a whole what's called Mizrahi Jewish group. And 20% of Israelis are Palestinian. They're native to the area, and they didn't leave when 48 happened. And you have Jews from Ethiopia. I mean, this is a very complicated society just in terms of where people came from and the heritage that they brought with them. And then politically, the large percentage of Israelis are actually secular. And that's always sort of interesting to find out. And the more religious people compose maybe 20% of the population. And then a smaller percentage of that are the very right-wing, this is all mine and you have to get out of here people. So there's a huge spectrum politically, religiously. The country as a whole has moved to the right. They did elect Netanyahu and Lieberman and people like that. So the political waves are rightward because people, I think, are afraid. There's a much more sense of nationalism and a lot of racism that is very endemic to the society, that's very troubling, when you look at how things are going. So it's a pretty complicated place, and I think to think of it as homogenized is just too simplified.
Mm-hmm. And the military, as you say, is almost a defining shared experience that every Israeli has.
Yes and no. The military is a defining shared experience. The part that's different now is that it used to be that everyone, men and women, went into the military except for the ultra-Orthodox and the Palestinians. According to New Profile, which is a feminist anti-military organization in Israel, only about half of Israeli youth now currently actually serve. And so this is a dramatic change over the last 20 years. And I think in some ways Israeli youth are talking with their feet, which means that it's now acceptable to get a psychiatric deferment, to go to the U.S. for college and miss being inducted, to do all sorts of ways to get out of the army that we knew in the Vietnam era. that's now a much more acceptable thing to do. And then there are people who are actively refusing, the refusers, the shim and esteem, who are high schoolers who are refusing before they get in. There are a lot of more of those kind of movements as well. But the majority of Israelis who don't serve either do alternative service or very quietly in some way get out. And I think that's a reflection of the difficulties the society is encountering now in terms of what is it doing and what does the occupation do to Israeli society, what is it doing to the soldiers, all those kind of issues that come up, you can see with what's happening with the army.
And do you find, you mentioned how it was growing up here in the United States, do you find, not being able to have those discussions at dinner, for example, about what was going on in Israel and Palestine, is this something that is happening in Israeli families too? Do you know that there's this discussion about the military that, will you or won't you go in? Is that happening a lot more?
I don't know. I think in some families, if the young person is bringing it up, then that must be happening. But there is a tremendous amount of patriotism and love of country, and people have that sense because it's a small place, and they've experienced violence and fear of suicide bombing and all that kind of stuff is very personal. It's not distant the way it is in the U.S. How much that gets discussed at dinner, I think you'd have to ask Israelis about that. I don't know, actually.
Okay. Let me remind our listeners that we're talking with Alice Rothschild, author of Broken Promises, Broken Dreams, Stories of Jewish and Palestinian Trauma and Resilience. Alice, let's turn to the system of tunnels that we hear so much about in the news, tunnels that apparently allow secret shipment of arms and ammunition into Gaza. Can you first describe the physical lay of the land in and around, say, a city like Rafah?
Okay, well, Gaza, first of all, is about 6 miles by 26 miles in size. So it's a tiny place. There are about 1.5 million people living there. Over half of them are under 18 years old. And because of the ongoing siege and then the worsening blockade and then the tremendous destruction during the bombardment and invasion of Gaza in December and January, the place is devastated. I mean, most people aren't working. Much of the sewer system is broken. The water is being contaminated by salt water because the Israelis bombed a huge number of wells. It's a humanitarian catastrophe, and people are starving. People are dying. I mean, this doesn't get into the news, but this is what's going on in Gaza. Rafah is the southernmost city adjacent to Egypt. And when I was in Rafah in 2005, there had been a clearing of a huge swath of territory between the border and, demolishing hundreds and hundreds of people's homes. Now things are even more devastated.
And those, let me interrupt for a second and say, those homes were demolished because of the tunnels?
No, those homes, well, there were two times recently that those homes were demolished by the time I'd been there. One is that they had the Israeli Defense Force had decided to set up a buffer zone, and so they wanted a greater swath of territory that didn't have people living in it between the Egyptian border and the town of Rafah. And then there was an Israeli operation, which I discuss in my book, and I just need to remember what
Operation the name was. Rainbow.
Huh? Yes.
Operation Rainbow.
Yes, which was theoretically to destroy the tunnels, although they didn't actually they didn't actually find the tunnels that they thought they were going to find, and that's all been documented by the Human Rights Watch report. But the tunnels, at that point, there weren't as many as people said they were, and they were mostly smuggling food and non-weaponry, and they're small. They're not very wide tunnels. And they're partly there because people are desperate, because they're sealed off. And so in the military operation that I mentioned in my book, the tunnels seem to be not as big a deal as the Israeli military force made it out to be. The tunnels now, I don't know personally what's going on with the tunnels, except it seems like there are probably a lot more of them. And the tunnels are partly there because Gazans are desperate, because they have no way to get food in and out, products in and out, and it's a major way to have an economy because people are hungry. And it's also obviously a way to have small arms go in and out. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I don't know the details of that at this point.
What I found interesting was you write, the degree of smuggling into Rafah was considered insignificant when compared to the bilateral overland smuggling of people, drugs, and goods along the lengthy Israeli-Egyptian border,
right,
which is largely in a desert area and has not been in the headlines.
Right.
Smuggling
so
people?
The tunnels are used politically.
Uh-huh.
Right. You know, and I think the people need to realize that, you know, Gazans can't fish without being shot at by Israeli military. They can't get out. They can't get their goods in. They can't. They're really under siege, and this creates a level of misery and desperation that we need to understand. This is going to lead to something terrible,
mm-hmm.
And you know, tunnels is just one response to the need to get things in and out of a very small, desperate area of the world.
Right, and I know there's oil has actually been discovered off the coast of Gaza now, so we will be doing shows about that in the future, but that has to do with shutting down or closing down the area in which Palestinians can actually fish.
Well, they keep narrowing the number of, you know, miles off shore they can fish.
Right.
And the shoreline has been contaminated by sewage because the Israelis bombed the sewer treatment plant. So
mm-hmm.
It's really desperate. I mean, the water system is falling apart. You know, the salinization is a major problem. The sewage is a major problem. And the thing that's interesting is, you know, these kind of problems don't know borders. So southern Israel and northern Egypt are also suffering from these problems because they don't just stay within Gaza.
Right.
So environmentally, it's pretty disastrous. And also, if you read the Goldstone Report, which is that report that was done by a UN human rights lawyer from South Africa, who's also a Jew and a Zionist, which is very interesting to me. And he condemned human rights violations by Hamas as well as Israel. But he documented sort of a mass contamination of a lot of the agricultural land using weaponry that has toxic chemicals in it that are going to have wreak havoc for decades to come. So the level of disaster is very high, and people are very desperate.
So as a doctor now, let's talk about what you saw in Gaza and also, in the West Bank in general. And talking to Palestinian doctors, what surprised you the most about?
You know, Gaza and the West Bank are in different levels of disrepair. I've spent much more time in the West Bank. And the things that are always striking to me when I travel in the West Bank, I travel as a Palestinian would or a Palestinian healthcare provider would. So either I'm in a taxi or in an ambulance. And so the first thing that's very striking is the impact of checkpoints on your ability to move from point A to point B. So, you know, I could be staying in Ramallah and be going to do a clinic in Tulkarm. And, you know, I had an experience trying to do that. I was in an ambulance. I had my U.S. passport. I had an invitation to Tulkarm, to the clinic there. I was in an ambulance that was a medical relief ambulance. I mean, this was as kosher as you could be. And we got to the main highway going north, and an Israeli soldier just said no. So first of all, that was a violation of the Geneva Accords, which says that, you know, medical personnel need to be able to travel unimpeded. So then we went back, got another vehicle, another driver, a buddy for him, and we went village to village to village through, I think it was 6 or 7 checkpoints to get to this clinic. So by the time I got to the clinic, the last patient had already been seen.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like that's the first thing. That's the typical kind of experience. You never know whether you're going to get where you're going to provide the care that you want to get or provide. And that's something that Palestinian healthcare providers talk about all the time, is this huge restriction of movement, both for themselves, for their patients, for their supplies, for medication, for all the things you could imagine that have to get from point A to point B. It's totally unpredictable if that will happen and how long it will happen. And this has a huge disruptive impact on healthcare. There are also small villages that people just can't get out. They can't get permits, so they don't get health care unless a mobile clinic comes. So that's a pretty big level of desperation. This also affects prenatal care. I mean, the average Palestinian woman has 6 children. That's a lot of prenatal visits and a lot of labors. And if you have to go through multiple checkpoints to get to a doctor or a clinic or a hospital, there's going to be catastrophe somewhere. So there's a steady stream of women delivering at checkpoints, bleeding to death at checkpoints, babies dying at checkpoints. 1 year when I was there, a set of premature twins died at a checkpoint. And this kind of stuff really happens. And, it's frequent enough that the Palestinian Medical Relief Society has its patient education pamphlets, like, you know, take your calcium, use a condom, you know, all the usual patient education stuff. They have a patient education pamphlet for pregnant women in labor who are stuck at checkpoints, who to call, what to do. Mm-hmm. So that means it's a real major issue. Mm-hmm. USAID also built 4 birthing centers so that women wouldn't have so far to go. Again, that was their response to the fact that women couldn't get to hospitals on time. So this is something that's a major human rights and medical issue. And this also impacts on education. You know, I know several medical students. There's a medical school in East Jerusalem called Al-Quds, and, you know, they never know whether they can get to class or not, or how long it's going to take. It's totally disruptive to getting to class, taking exams, doing rotations. All that kind of stuff is disrupted by the system of checkpoints. And then with the separation wall, which is theoretically was supposed to separate Israel from the West Bank, Jews from Palestinians, but in actuality wends its way into the West Bank in a sort of snake-like manner, so that very often not only does it get the Jewish settlements on the Israeli side, it also includes thousands and thousands of Palestinians on the Israeli side who are now trapped between the Green Line, which is the armistice line, and the wall. This also totally disrupts people's ability to get from point A to point B. So this is a major, major issue for health care. And then, you know, with the dysfunctions and corruptions of the Palestinian Authority and the Ministry of Health, which has, you know, sort of been trying to function against all odds, it hasn't been able to do it. And to ask a group of providers to develop a healthcare system under occupation, even in the best of circumstances, would be extremely difficult. It's made more difficult by the political climate that's going on as well. And, you know, Gaza's just infinitely worse because hospitals have been bombed, clinics have been bombed. There's no medicine. I mean, it's in a much worse state. And there was a lot of relief sent to Gaza, but it's sitting at the checkpoints and can't get through. So the level of injustice is very, very high in the world of medicine.
Again, this is KZSU, Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, talking with Dr. Alice Rothschild, author of Broken Promises, Broken Dreams, Stories of Jewish and Palestinian Trauma and Resilience. You actually mentioned something that I would like to surface a little bit. The Geneva Conventions, you mentioned that preventing people from going through these checkpoints is actually against the Geneva Conventions. Mm-hmm. Do you think the soldiers actually know anything about the Geneva Conventions?
I don't know. I mean, I've talked with soldiers who have come away from their experience in the Army and reflected on it and been ashamed of what they've done. What they have felt is that their sense of entitlement and their sense of dehumanization of Palestinians made it possible for them to behave in ways that are really not defensible. You know, a lot of soldiers are like 18, 19, 20 years old. Very often it's the less educated soldiers who end up at the checkpoint watch. I mean, this is a horrible thing to have to stand at a checkpoint for hours and hours and hours. You know, you have a big gun, you're a big bully, and you have hundreds and hundreds of people, many of them women and children, that you have total control over. I mean, it's boring, it's scary, it's tiring. I mean, it's not a fun job at all. And I don't think that it brings out the best in people to do this. And, you know, one of the things that a lot of peace organizations in Israel talk about is, what is the cost to Israelis of being occupiers? What is the cost to their children of living in this heavily militarized society? What does it cost to a young man to spend several very formative years being in this kind of role where you have huge amount of control over civilians who are just trying to get to their mothers or their school or whatever they're trying to do? So I don't know how much you know, the sort of grunts in the Army learn about human rights conventions. Mm-hmm. But I can say that they behave like they haven't heard about it.
Right.
And also, it's putting young people in an untenable position. I mean, I'm very appalled by Israeli foreign policy, but I feel a lot of sadness for the young men and women who are put in the situation, which only brings out the most brutalizing side of a person. And I think we have to look at that and say, is that what we want to happen to the young people of Israel?
Mm-hmm.
Because it has, you know, the occupation has come home. It doesn't just stay in the West Bank. You know, people, young people with big guns come home and there's more domestic violence and there's more shooting in the streets and there's more hot tempers. And, you know, people, it's sort of everything's ratcheted up, and that's sort of what the Israeli personality is supposed to be. And that's part of the cost of being an occupier and being allowed to do things to people that you shouldn't be allowed to do. So that's how I would come out on that question.
Yeah, and actually there's a lot of similarities with the military here, except, as you say, it doesn't come home in quite the same way, although it does come home. And I know that our troops in the American military get about an hour and a half's worth of Geneva Conventions training. And I've actually tried to read the Geneva Conventions, and they're very long. You simply cannot do them in less than a day. So that's one of the questions that I try and learn, you know, about soldiers in general. But everything you say, I think, is very accurate also to American troops. What are some of the other moral dimensions of this conflict for you?
Well, I think that one of the big moral questions for me is, what is the role of U.S. Jews and the United States in this conflict? And by that, what I mean is that, for instance, U.S. Jews as a sort of group, and again, it's very dangerous to sort of use a one stroke to talk about U.S. Jewry, but the sort of mainstream Jewish community in the United States walks in line with Israeli policy no matter what it does, and is very intolerant of any critical dissent. And I would argue that that's both bad for us as human beings, and it's also bad for Israel. It comes under what I call the friends don't let friends drive drunk rule, so that if we see our brothers and sisters in Israel doing things that we find morally indefensible, then we have to say something. And it's not just because we have to say something, but we have to say something because it's good for us and them. And so that's a very big moral dilemma for me. So, for instance, with the Goldstone Report, which, you know, I don't think it gets any better than having a Zionist Jewish South African human rights lawyer. I mean, that's as good as it's going to get. For the Jewish community, mainstream community, to come down so heavily against this report makes me want to cry, because if we don't face up to what's in this report, we as Jews and Israelis in general are going to lose any moral credibility in the world. And I think, you know, just as the United States was made stronger by facing up to its history of slavery, the civil rights struggle, all the things that we are ashamed of in our history, Israelis and Jews need to do that too. And so for me, one big moral dilemma is how the Jewish American population blindly supports everything that Israeli government does. And I think that's really a problem. And then the U.S. government in general, I mean, it's billions of aid every year. And for what? You know, there's a huge military establishment that is very intermixed with our military establishment. You know, they try out our weapons. We, you know, they do our dirty work. I mean, it's very disturbing when you start really researching this stuff. I think this is a really dangerous relationship, and it's dangerous for all of us. And it raises moral, ethical, political questions for me and for many people.
Well, let's finish off our conversation here. We're coming full circle with talking about how Israel is actually marketed in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's definitely marketed in the U.S. I love the ads in the New York Times where they have a beautiful Tel Aviv beach and they say, you know, Shalom, come to Israel. You know, the marketing is, you know, we're a beautiful country, Mediterranean, gorgeous women, gorgeous beaches. Come live with us and we'll welcome you. And there's also very strong marketing on campuses, and there are the right-wing Muslim kind of organizations such as CAMRA and Campus Watch and the David Project that try to do what they call Israel messaging to promote a certain view of Israel as the victim, as the good guy, as a country that would do no wrong. I mean, just sort of a mythological kind of Israel. And this marketing is very, very intense. And one of the ways you see it is in the birthright trips, so that any Jewish person in the United States between, I think it's 18 and 26 or something like that, can get a free trip to Israel. And basically the goal, and to go on this tour, and the goal is to build, you know, a love of Israel that is very uncritical. And I think that that's dangerous, and that that is not going to lead us in a positive direction. So I know many, many young people who've been on Birthright, and you know, it's a very propaganda kind of trip, And I don't think we're doing ourselves any favors to try to simplify things too much. And also, it really feeds into fear and racism. And until we as Jews and Israelis as human beings really face the racism that's endemic in their society, this is never going to get better. I mean, if you think about it, here's a country where something like 94% of the land can only be sold to Jews, where there's territory where there are separate roads for Jews, for Israelis, and for Palestinians, where there's a separate legal system in the West Bank for Jews and Palestinians, where, you know, I mean, you just start going down the list and you think, oh my God, this is a problem here. And so, you know, there's sort of Jim Crow and there's apartheid. I mean, there's both of those things percolating in their own particular version that is not good for anybody. And until we really face those kind of moral questions, we're not going to get anywhere. So the first thing is to get educated and to face them, and then to speak out loud about them, and not to be afraid of what's going to happen when you do. Because generally, when you do, someone starts yelling at you, or you know, mm-hmm. some offensive thing happens. So I think it's very important for people to just state what they see, because that really can't be disputed.
Alice Rothschild, Broken Promises, Broken Dreams, Stories of Jewish and Palestinian Trauma and Resilience. There's a new edition coming out soon. Or...
Right, in February. And it's also being translated into Hebrew and German, so I'm very excited.
Great. Well, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you.
That was author Alice Rothschild and her book, Broken Promises, Broken Dreams. This is published by Pluto Press and available online or at your local bookstore. There are two events coming up in November you should know about, from the 20th to the 22nd. Converge on Fort Benning, Georgia, for the mass mobilization to shut down the School of the Americas, SOA, also known as the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security and Cooperation. Learn more about that mass mobilization at soaw.org, schooloftheamericas.org. Then from November 26th to the 29th, you can protest the use of drones or unmanned aerial vehicles, again outside the gates of Creche Air Force Base in Nevada. This is the third such protest, and you can find out more about this at nodrones.com, nodrones.com. TED is a small nonprofit devoted to ideas worth spreading. It started out as a conference bringing together people from three worlds: technology, entertainment, and design. TED invited Dr. Jill Bolte-Taylor to present on December 10th, 2008. This means this is almost a year old, but it's such a wonderful presentation that I believe it should be spread far and wide, and this is my attempt to do it here today on Raising Sand Radio. Dr. Jill Bolte-Taylor is a trained and published neuroanatomist. Her specialty is in the post-mortem investigation of the human brain as it relates to schizophrenia and the severe mental illnesses. As irony would have it, in December 1996, Dr. Taylor woke up to discover that she was experiencing a rare form of stroke. Later, it was found to be an arteriovenous malformation, or AVM. 2.5 weeks later, Dr. Taylor underwent major brain surgery to remove a golf ball-sized blood clot that was placing pressure on the language centers in the left hemisphere of her brain. It took 8 years for Dr. Taylor to successfully rebuild her brain from the inside out. In response to the swelling and trauma of the stroke, which placed pressure on her dominant left hemisphere, the functions of her right hemisphere blossomed. Among other things, today she creates unique stained glass brains.
I grew up to study the brain because I have a brother who has been diagnosed with a brain disorder, schizophrenia. And as a sister, and later as a scientist, I wanted to understand, why is it that I can take my dreams, I can connect them to my reality, and I can make my dreams come true? What is it about my brother's brain and his schizophrenia that he cannot connect his dreams to a common and shared reality, so they instead become delusion? So I dedicated my career to research into the severe mental illnesses. And I moved from my home state of Indiana to Boston, where I was working in the lab of Dr. Francine Bennis in the Harvard Department of Psychiatry. And in the lab, we were asking the question, what are the biological differences between the brains of individuals who would be diagnosed as normal control as compared with the brains of individuals diagnosed with schizophrenia, schizoaffective, or bipolar disorder? So we were essentially mapping the microcircuitry of the brain, which cells are communicating with which cells, with which chemicals, and then in what quantities of those chemicals. So there was a lot of meaning in my life because I was performing this type of research during the day. But then in the evenings and on the weekends, I traveled as an advocate for NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. But on the morning of December 10, 1996, I woke up to discover that I had a brain disorder of my own. A blood vessel exploded in the left half of my brain. And in the course of 4 hours, I watched my brain completely deteriorate in its ability to process all information. On the morning of the hemorrhage, I could not walk, talk, read, write, or recall any of my life. I essentially became an infant in a woman's body.
You're listening to Dr. Jill Balty-Taylor discuss the day she observed herself have a rare form of stroke and what she learned from that benefits all of us concerned with peace.
If you've ever seen a human brain, it's obvious that the two hemispheres are completely separate from one another. And when you look at the brain, it's obvious that the two cerebral cortices are completely separate from one another. For those of you who understand computers, our right hemisphere functions like a parallel processor, while our left hemisphere functions like a serial processor. The two hemispheres do communicate with one another through the corpus callosum, which is made up of some 300 million axonal fibers. But other than that, the two hemispheres are completely separate. Because they process information differently, each of our hemisphere think about different things. They care about different things, and dare I say, they have very different personalities. Our right human hemisphere is all about this present moment. It's all about right here, right now. Our right hemisphere, it thinks in pictures, and it learns kinesthetically through the movement of our bodies. Information in the form of energy streams in simultaneously through all of our sensory systems, and then it explodes into this enormous collage of what this present moment looks like, what this present moment smells like and tastes like, what it feels like, and what it sounds like.
You're listening to Dr. Jill Balty-Taylor discuss the day she observed herself have a rare form of stroke.
I am an energy being connected to the energy all around me through the consciousness of my right hemisphere. We are energy beings connected to one another through the consciousness of our right hemispheres as one human family. And right here, right now, we are brothers and sisters on this planet here to make the world a better place. And in this moment, we are perfect, we are whole, and we are beautiful. My left hemisphere, our left hemisphere, is a very different place. Our left hemisphere thinks linearly and methodically. Our left hemisphere is all about the past, and it's all about the future. Our left hemisphere is designed to take that enormous collage of the present moment and start picking out details, details, and more details about those details. It then categorizes and organizes all that information, associates it with everything in the past we've ever learned, and projects into the future all of our possibilities. And our left hemisphere thinks in language. It's that ongoing brain chatter that connects me and my internal world to my external world. It's that little voice that says to me, hey, you got to remember to pick up bananas on your way home. I need them in the morning. It's that calculating intelligence that knows, that reminds me when I have to do my laundry. But perhaps most important, it's that little voice that says to me, I am. I am. And as soon as my left hemisphere says to me, I am, I become separate. I become a single, solid individual, separate from the energy flow around me and separate from you. And this is a portion of my brain that I lost on the morning of my stroke. On the morning of the stroke, I woke up to a pounding pain behind my left eye. And it was the kind of pain, caustic pain, that you get when you bite into ice cream. And it just gripped me. And then it released me. And then it just gripped me. And then it released me. And it was very unusual for me to ever experience any kind of pain. So I thought, okay, I'll just start my normal routine. So I got up and I jumped onto my CardioGlider, which is a full body, full exercise machine. And I'm jamming away on this thing. And I'm realizing that my hands look like primitive claws grasping onto the bar. And I thought, that's very peculiar. And I looked down at my body and I thought, whoa, I'm a weird looking thing. And it was as though my consciousness had shifted away from my normal perception of reality, where I'm the person on the machine having the experience, to some esoteric space where I'm witnessing myself having this experience. And it was all very peculiar, and my headache was just getting worse. So I get off the machine, and I'm walking across my living room floor, and I realize that everything inside of my body has slowed way down. And every step is very rigid and very deliberate. There's no fluidity to my pace, and there's this constriction in my area of perception. So I'm just focused on internal systems. And I'm standing in my bathroom getting ready to step into the shower, and I could actually hear the dialogue inside of my body. I heard a little voice saying, okay, you muscles, you got to contract, and you muscles, you relax. And then I lost my balance, and I'm propped up against the wall. And I looked down at my arm, and I realized that I can no longer define the boundaries of my body. I can't define where I begin and where I end, because the atoms and the molecules of my arm blended with the atoms and molecules of the wall. And all I could detect was this energy. And I'm asking myself, what is wrong with me? What is going on? And in that moment, my brain chatter, my left hemisphere brain chatter, went totally silent. Just like someone took a remote control and pushed the mute button. Total silence. And at first, I was shocked to find myself inside of a silent mind. But then I was immediately captivated by the magnificence of the energy around me. And because I could no longer identify the boundaries of my body, I felt enormous and expansive. I felt at one with all the energy that was, and it was beautiful there. And then all of a sudden, my left hemisphere comes back online, and it says to me, hey, we got a problem. We got to get some help. And I'm going, oh, I got a problem. So it's like, okay, I got a problem. But then I immediately drifted right back out into the consciousness, and I affectionately refer to this space as La La Land. But it was beautiful there. Imagine what it would be like to be totally disconnected from your brain chatter that connects you to the external world. So here I am in this space, and my job and any stress related to my job, it was gone. And I felt lighter in my body. And imagine all of the relationships in the external world and any stressors related to any of those, they were gone. And I felt this sense of peacefulness. And imagine what it would feel like to lose 37 years of emotional baggage. Oh, I felt euphoria. Euphoria. It was beautiful there. And then again, my left hemisphere comes online and it says, hey, you've got to pay attention. We've got to get help. And I'm thinking, I got to get help. I got to focus. So I get out of the shower and I mechanically dress and I'm walking around my apartment and I'm thinking, I got to get to work. Can I drive? And in that moment, my right arm went totally paralyzed by my side. Then I realized, oh my gosh, I'm having a stroke. And then the next thing my brain says to me is, wow, this is so cool. How many brain scientists have the opportunity to study their own brain from the inside out? And then it crosses my mind, but I'm a very busy woman. I don't have time for a stroke. It's like, okay, I can't stop the stroke from happening, so I'll do this for a week or two, and then I'll get back to my routine. Okay, so I got to call help. I got to call work. I could remember the number at work. So I remembered in my office I had a business card with my number on it. So I go into my business room, and I pull out a 3-inch stack of business cards, and I'm looking at the card on top. And even though I could see clearly in my mind's eye what my business card looked like, I couldn't tell if this was my card or not, because all I could see were pixels. And the pixels of the words blended with the pixels of the background and the pixels of the symbols, and I just couldn't tell. And then I would wait for what I call a wave of clarity. And in that moment, I would be able to reattach to normal reality. And I could tell, that's not the card, that's not the card, that's not the card. It took me 45 minutes to get 1 inch down inside of that stack of cards. In the meantime, for 45 minutes, the hemorrhage is getting bigger in my left hemisphere. I do not understand numbers. I do not understand a telephone, but it's the only plan I have. So I take the phone pad and I put it right here. I take the business card, I put it right here, and I'm matching the shape of the squiggles on the card to the shape of the squiggles on the foam pad. But then I would drift back out into La La Land and not remember if when I come back if I'd already dialed those numbers. So I had to wield my paralyzed arm like a stump and cover the numbers as I went along and push them so that as I would come back to normal reality, I'd be able to tell, yes, I've already dialed that number. Eventually, the whole number gets dialed, and I'm listening to the phone, and my colleague picks up the phone, and he says to me, and I think to myself, oh my gosh, he sounds like a golden retriever. And so I say to him, clear in my mind, I say to him, this is Jill, I need help. And what comes out of my voice is, roo, roo, roo. And I think, oh my gosh, I sound like a golden retriever. So I didn't know that I couldn't speak or understand language until I tried. So he recognizes that I need help, and he gets me help. And a little while later, I'm riding in an ambulance from one hospital across Boston to Mass General Hospital. And I curl up into a little fetal ball. And just like a balloon with the last bit of air just right out of the balloon, I just felt my energy lift and just, I felt my spirit surrender. And in that moment, I knew that I was no longer the choreographer of my life. And either the doctors rescue my body and give me a second chance at life, or this was perhaps my moment of transition. When I woke later that afternoon, I was shocked to discover that I was still alive. When I felt my spirit surrender, I said goodbye to my life, and my mind was now suspended between two very opposite planes of reality. Stimulation coming in through my sensory systems felt like pure pain. Light burned my brain like wildfire, and sounds were so loud and chaotic that I could not pick a voice out from the background noise, and I just wanted to escape because I could not identify the position of my body in space. I felt enormous and expansive, like a genie just liberated from her bottle. And my spirit soared free like a great whale gliding through a sea of silent euphoria. Nirvana. I found nirvana. And I remember thinking, there's no way I would ever be able to squeeze the enormousness of myself back inside this tiny little body. But then I realized, but I'm still alive. I'm still alive, and I have found nirvana. And if I have found nirvana, and I'm still alive, then everyone who is alive can find nirvana. And I pictured a world filled with beautiful, peaceful, compassionate, loving people who knew that they could come to this space at any time, and that they could purposely choose to step to the right of their left hemispheres and find this peace. And then I realized what a tremendous gift this experience could be. What a stroke of insight this could be to how we live our lives. And it motivated me to recover. 2.5 weeks after the hemorrhage, the surgeons went in, and they removed a blood clot the size of a golf ball that was pushing on my language centers. Here I am with my mama, who's a true angel in my life. It took me 8 years to completely recover. So who are we? We are the life force power of the universe with manual dexterity and two cognitive minds. And we have the power to choose moment by moment who and how we want to be in the world. Right here, right now, I can step into the consciousness of my right hemisphere where we are. I am the life force power of the universe. I am the life force power of the 50 trillion beautiful molecular geniuses that make up my form, at one with all that is. Or I can choose to step into the consciousness of my left hemisphere, where I become a single individual, a solid, separate from the flow, separate from you. I am Dr. Jill Bolte Taylor, intellectual, neuroanatomist. These are the we inside of me. Which would you choose? Which do you choose? And when? I believe that the more time we spend choosing to run the deep inner peace circuitry of our right hemispheres, the more peace we will project into the world, and the more peaceful our planet will be. And I thought that was an idea worth spreading.
That was Dr. Jill Bolte Taylor presenting the results of her stroke at the TED conference in 2008. You can find this on YouTube. It's really well worth watching. And that's our show for the week. As usual, all views and opinions are those of the host and guests and not KZSU or Stanford University. You can contact me, Susan, at raisingsandradio.org, and we'll go out with Amina and Galuli from the album Yalil.